Right. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday at JM and the AM. Mr. Hohnlein, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Malcolm.
You're also one of those who is criticized for not knowing how to take a vacation properly?
Very often.
I know what it's
almost
like.
Constantly.
I know what it's like, but I'll tell you, some people are really, really bad at it. Malcolm, we have discussed this issue so many times. I think most people get both of our perspectives, which I think are very similar on these issues. But with the events of the week, I just want to run it by you one more time. And, of course, it's the issue of a boycott, inviting certain guests, not inviting certain guests. We know what happened with Cardozo Law School and the club that invited Jimmy Carter. That happened this week. We know about Pamela Geller and what happened with Great Neck Synagogue. She is now not appearing at Great Neck Synagogue on Sunday. She'll instead be invited by Chabad of Great Neck at 10 a.m. Sunday morning. So many people are curious about your perspective again on who to invite, when to invite, and when, in fact, to cancel events when under pressure. What do you think?
And then the added question about when is it smart to go public and not. In the ways that we saw this week. Look, I think people have to do research before the event, not after the event. And not every situation is parallel. But we have to think also of the precedents that are set. When Jimmy Carter gets invited, it was done by a publication. It was not even done by the law school, let alone by the university, which came out very clearly with a statement about it. And then when you hype it this way and there's no demonstration at all against him, so everybody says, look at all the hype, and then there's no price, there's no follow-up about people expressing in appropriate ways their opposition. And then others who will book Carter in the future will be able to say, look, if Yeshiva University can have him, or and not even identifying the real sponsor of the event. And in universities where academic freedom and freedom of speech and all these things are touted,
right,
when a publication of the school extends the invitation, now the question is, what's wrong with the education that we give our young people that they feel that somebody like Jimmy Carter is worthy of any honor, given what he has said, his books, his attacks on Israel on a constant basis. And I think it's regrettable that the freedom of speech has supported everybody, but if somebody is a critic, seen as a critic of Islam, and Pamela Geller makes the point that she's a critic of Islamists, not Islam,
right?
It's regrettable. But I mean, the synagogue obviously had security concerns, and I don't think that the criticisms and other things should be directed there. I think that the double standard is what bothers me so much, and that somebody, even if you don't agree with the views, but you should at least know what the views are, but people have a right to protest it.
You made so many critical points in this, but I just want to emphasize two of them. One, do your research beforehand. Understand what is going to happen, what might happen, and what the reaction has been beforehand when certain guests are invited. I think that's an extremely important point. And I love your other point on what does it say about how we're educating our children, our youth, those who end up being leaders in positions where they're able to invite guests. Look, in fact, who oftentimes they are inviting. Two very, very, I mean, again, many important points, but those two in particular. And then again, another topic where so many people are curious regarding your reaction, and I don't even know what my reaction is to this yet. I'm sure you've read, you've heard about Natan Sharansky's proposed compromise when it comes to the Western Wall, and no doubt all of us look at this issue with very carefully. What did you think of his proposal?
Well, it's a complicated proposal because it involves extending the plaza, and I think that it's an attempt, and I respect Natan greatly, and I think he's really motivated by trying to bring Achdut back and find some resolution to this.
No question.
Because in the media, it looks horrific. Again,
right.
Yesterday,
right.
The demonstration, and
right.
then it's not a one-sided issue. The court ruled that they shouldn't wear talitot or tefillin, and they, of course, then individuals do it, and it becomes again an affront, and then the police move in, and then the media picks up that without giving context where they were allowed to daven. It's not that people can't daven. But again, the key here is sensitivity. There's no reason there can't be a resolution, you know, with the Robinson Arch proposal, with other things that people have accepted, the Rabbanut accepted. Everybody then draws lines in the sand and provokes, and therefore you heat up a situation which makes resolution more and more difficult. I don't know that this resolution will work. I hope it does, because I think that the portrayal of this and the misrepresentation so much in the media about what the real issues here are. So again, I think it's a question of people putting aside a lot of hype and their personal interests and try to come together to find a resolution.
The most credible part of this resolution is its sponsor, right? But if it was anyone else but Sharansky, probably people would be rolling their eyes a lot more.
That's true, and the Sharansky was appointed by the Prime Minister, so he has the blessing of the Prime Minister, and I know that, you know, he's somebody who is Makir Rabbanim. He's not somebody
right.
who's hostile and who's coming at this...
Right, the agenda's not there.
Right, exactly, and I think that's your point, is that he is somebody
right.
who is seen as and has proven himself to be above partisanship in this regard.
Crazy world out there, and one of the things we got to do this week was relive some of the things of years ago. Before we talk about the events of today, many are curious about how you view Margaret Thatcher and her relationship with Israel.
I had the privilege of meeting Margaret Thatcher, and she was... you know, it's amazing to see how somebody who did so much, I think she was prime minister 11 years, the longest that any post-war, certainly post-war prime minister and probably even before served. She accomplished so much for England and Great Britain. She was somebody of principle who stood by those principles, and one of those was support for Israel. And the fact that the prime minister is amongst the world leaders who will be going for her funeral, even though it's before Memorial Day and Independence Day in Israel,
right.
is a testament to the friendship she had for the Jewish people, for the state of Israel. And, you know, the criticisms now, especially in the British press, and we're dissecting her and attacking her, is so horrific. It's a revisionist history. She was, you know, because she was described as the Iron Lady in the movie made about her, so everybody thinks they know all there is to know about Margaret Thatcher. And I can tell you my discussions with her, they weren't as extensive as I would have liked, but she was so intelligent and so principled. And we should remember that we have a lot of hakara hatov for her.
We've been privileged that in recent generations there have been some great leaders who've had great affinity to the state of Israel. It has not always been that way, Malcolm, we should remind everybody.
Exactly, and it doesn't mean that because you have one prime minister of Great Britain that the others who follow will all continue in that path.
So right, even if they're from the same party.
Even from the same party, but we have another leader right now, and that's the foreign minister of Canada, who broke a bunch of taboos in this week. And people should recognize, and especially those who are Canadians who listen, that he met with the Minister Tzipi Livni, the Justice Minister, in her office in Eastern Yerushalayim. And most countries, including the U.S., refused to let officials meet there. And he also visited the Golan Heights.
Wow.
And he said that he said he recognized the sensitivities. It was said about him, but he certainly set a precedent in this. And it should be recognized.
Malcolm, now that Drudge has proclaimed that North Korea has the nuclear arsenal, now do you think people will start believing it? A bombshell out of the House Armed Services Committee hearing on Thursday, the results of a classified Defense Intelligence Agency report indicate that, quote, North Korea now has nuclear weapons capable of delivery by ballistic missiles. It's amazing. When Drudge writes it, everyone starts paying attention. When Homeline's been saying it for months, we didn't get the same type of reaction.
I assume that's where Drudge got it. To the show. Listen, I wish we could laugh about it, but the danger here is I do not believe North Korea will go to war, and the truth is that the ability to strike is limited. They're not going to attack China. There could be a conflict with South Korea. We've had it before, and of course it is significant, and certainly Japan is hypersensitive and concerned, in fact, apoplectic about it. And
right.
It's what enabled me to get the Prime Minister of Japan to pay attention is when I talked about the North Korea-Iran axis many years ago. So this is not new, but the degree of cooperation, if people will remember, the Syrian nuclear reactor was a North Korean-Iranian project.
Right.
And which, thank God, Israel took out to no applause then, but certainly everybody has to think about how grateful they are, as with the Iraq Os Iraq nuclear reactor in Iraq. So what we have to remember is this relationship that what I believe goes on in North Korea is Iran. What Iran does is North Korea. The technology for the missiles in Iran is North Korean. We believe a lot of the nuclear stuff is Iran, and that Iranians are there whenever the North Koreans do these nuclear tests. So it's a synergistic relationship. It should be of even greater concern because of that, but also because of the message that we send, that the Ayatollah looks at how North Korea is treated and says, if they can get away with it, me, with all the power we have compared to North Korea, which is a failed economy, a failed state, you know, of such little significance, we should be able to crush them. And we have sanctions against them. Obviously, their economy is very weak, but they can devote all of these resources and continue this vile dictatorship. You know, people I know tend to hear these reports and let them pass, but when, you know, we hear the Secretary of State using the same language about North Korea now that they use about Iran, that we will not allow them to have a nuclear weapon.
And not just the same language, but the same language as was said 10 years ago. You know, language is just completely irrelevant to the enemy today.
On both cases.
Right.
Exactly.
Malcolm, the level of intervention, or lack thereof, of the U.S., for instance, in the Syrian situation, is a great concern to many. Would the U.S. be more inclined to intervene if North Korea would start up with South Korea?
Well, the United States has commitments to rightfully to South Korea. It would depend a lot on the circumstances, but the real danger is not so much that North Korea will make a determination to go to war, but this is the kind of thing that an accident, an incident, maybe not even fully intentional, but when you're cheek to jowl, as North and South Korea are, and when you have so many possibilities that a missile launch goes awry, something else happens that could easily trigger an all-out war. The United States, you know, has to deliver if we want to have any credibility.
Right, I'll have no choice. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Was Israel the target of cyber attacks, government websites the target of cyber attacks this week?
They were over the last couple weeks, but it's almost constant. There are thousands and thousands of attacks every single day against Israel government agencies, against the electric companies or utilities, against companies. Israel constantly works to update and upgrade their counter cyber warfare capacity and have whole units working on it. And there was a massive attack planned for Yom HaShoah on Monday. And Israel took the necessary steps. There was some minor successes, but overall, Israel both built the defenses, being prepared for it, and also went on the offense and attacked some of the sites of those who are attacking.
Unbelievable!
But it should remind us that cyber warfare is the new front, and that we're going to see more and more, and it can't be dismissed, because you can shut down utilities, you can shut down services, you can, you know, sabotage economies by destroying the websites, and as you saw it with Stuxnet against the nuclear program in Iran and many other cases around the world.
But isn't it so difficult for a small, young 65-year-old country to go up against everybody else in these cyber wars?
It is difficult, but Israel, as the startup nation, is on the cutting edge of technology, and takes it seriously, and tries to act preemptively, and Israeli security and software in these areas and personnel are working all over the world because people really respect what Israel has achieved and what has to offer in this regard. But, you know, Iran has many people, some say thousands even, working in cyber warfare. And you can, you know, attack, for these terrorist organizations can attack bank accounts, they can steal money, they can do many other things by manipulating the internet and attacking people.
Oh, wow.
And as you know, with identity theft, just think of this, and what it can do to an individual or a family, and to their, take some years to straighten the records out. Just think about what it does to a country and how much more complex it is.
Any special reason that now members of parliament in Jordan are calling for the release of this madman who murdered seven Israeli schoolgirls back in 1997?
There's no particular reason except that the Islamists are feeling their oats and that Jordan's situation is very delicate, and I think they feel that they have more leverage right now. The king, who will be coming to the United States soon, and we'll be seeing him, is embattled. So I guess they just feel they can take advantage of the situation to put pressure on for his release.
Do you remember this, when King Hussein actually went to visit the families during Shiva?
And it was a dramatic move when he went and asked for forgiveness from the families, and it certainly was a bold and step that people did not anticipate.
That's for sure. And while we're on the subject of headlines that are making news this morning, Turkish police, according to the Jerusalem Post, have uncovered a plot to bomb a synagogue. What are the details on this al-Qaeda plot?
Well, this is a very complicated situation because it's not the first, and there are numerous instances that have been reported over the years of attempts, and there have been some successful attempts, both targeting Jewish institutions, but this was also targeting the U.S. Embassy. They seized nearly 50 pounds of plastic explosives with detonation detonation systems were already in place.
Wow.
And they found the laptop computers that were supposed to connect it, and they did an analysis, and they found that the targets were the U.S. Embassy and a shul in the Balat district of Istanbul, and they had floor plans and other information there. But this is linked to al-Qaeda. And for those, again, something we've talked about so many times since bin Laden's death, that people who think al-Qaeda is finished, al-Qaeda is dead, they don't understand the nature of al-Qaeda, and that it is a hydra, a multi-headed monster that has independent divisions everywhere, and that not dependent upon a particular leader, even if he could be the face of the movement. We see it this week in a very dramatic story that I think is not appreciated in the West, where a group called the Islamic State of Iraq announced that al-Nusra, a group I've mentioned many times here, that is becoming more and more aggressive in Syria, fighting in Syria, coming from Iraq. And I said always that this was al-Qaeda in Iraq. Well, they announced it, and they announced their merger with al-Nusra to have this Islamic state of Syria, of Iraq and the Levant, meaning Syria and Lebanon. But the announcement and the fact that all of this is operating out of Iraq, and the government of Iraq has done so little to try to stop it, and the aggressive nature of al-Nusra, and what is interesting is that this al-Nusra, al-Qaeda group, has targeted a central area called Rakat, which is between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, where you have the agriculture. They control 90% of the oil wells. The gas is in that section as well, and they are trying all the time to expand their role, but in this move to control the economy for post-Assad, they plan ahead. Too often, we, the West and others, think of the immediate situation and don't even respond. We often respond retroactively.
Right.
And here you see how far-sighted they are. We see the influx of Libyan weapons now in even greater number. The UN, yes, they decided that they finally that they're going to investigate 12 countries where Libyan arms are, but particularly the Sinai and Syria are being flooded with more and more sophisticated weapons, still come pouring out of Libya, so you can understand how much Gaddafi was able to assemble of sophisticated weapons, including these portable anti-aircraft and air defense systems. So it's not, you know, rifles and bullets. These are far more sophisticated systems than people tend to realize and what they mean. We see the war in Mali is fueled because of the weapons that came from Libya and Syria, now increasingly true.
Unbelievable. Is the Secretary of State dealing with this issue, or is he most with everything going on in with everything going on with North Korea? I wonder if his attention, which is really supposed to be focused on the Israeli PA peace process at this time, if that's going to be diverted because of all these other more important issues that are arising.
Well, I think it's going to be diverted because there's no real basis right now, I think, for peace negotiations. What you could do is steps to improve the economy. That's something both Israel and the Palestinians agreed to, as they said today, with sewage plants, with other things, economic development in Area C. But the Secretary of State, I think, fell into a partial trap with some of the proposals and talking about pushing the 2002 Arab League program, the Saudi plan, with some modifications in terms of Israel's security and about the border issue. But Israel says, listen, we're not ready just to have negotiations on borders and security if you're not going to talk, in parallel at least, about the key issues, the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, the public recognition, and on the issue of refugees, what they call the right of return, which is no right, and there will be no return. But if you don't resolve those issues, so you negotiate away the key issues, and then when we'll come to that, they will just raise the demands and raise the demands.
And there seems to be disarray in the PA. I remind everybody that the president of the PA is Mahmoud Abbas. The prime minister is Salam Fayyad, and supposedly, as of this morning, he was not supposed to be prime minister anymore. What happened there?
This is an ongoing battle that has gone on for many years. Fayyad has no real standing. He's not one of those who was a fighter and didn't have the record, and so in Fatah he didn't have the standing, but he was loved and is loved by the West. And the U.S. and the Europeans essentially have intervened repeatedly to save him, as Abbas wanted to throw him out. And he was seen as Mr. Clean, that he was introducing transparency, which he did. Unfortunately, he's become also more political and has lent himself to statements that were not that were also more radicalized. But he built no real independent political constituency inside the country. He has it outside, but that has worked his detriment because they talk about him as a foreign agent. So it's hurt him, his standing, because the West defends him. But on the other hand, Abbas couldn't get rid of him, knowing that it would hurt their donor base and the aid that they get. But Fayyad, his picture yesterday was being burnt in demonstrations in the streets. There have been long-time demonstrations to get him. They're escalated, and they come from Fatah. It's not talking about Hamas demonstrations. His tenure, he's been in and out so many times, it's not surprising, but it is significant. I mean, the people in the West Bank see the corruption. They all identify, it's overwhelming, like three-quarters in every poll talk about the corruption of the government. And he was the one light that was supposed to try to straighten it out. And that's part of the problem, is that you're not dealing with a government, you're not dealing with Abbas, somebody who's really ready to negotiate. The secretary said that he left saying he has homework to do, and that there was some progress. But number one, if you want to get negotiations, real negotiations, the stuff has to be done in the back room, and you're not going to get Israel, as has been talked about, the demands from the PA to free prisoners, give up territory in advance. They said no preconditions. President Obama said it when he was in Israel, and that has to be the rule, that they want to sit down and talk. But the fact is, I don't believe he wants to talk.
He seems wishy-washy as a Secretary of State. Doesn't have that definitive type of presentation that so many in the past have had.
Well, if he's trying to get negotiations going, it is his style, I think. But when you're trying to bring parties together, you don't want to lock everybody in, and he's trying to encourage them. Israel was a willing partner to try to see if there was anything serious that could be done. But I think the frustration that they have is that the Palestinians once again demonstrate that they're not prepared, and the situation is worsening every day in the region. You see the situation in Jordan, we see the situation in Syria, in Lebanon, I mean, everywhere. Egypt deteriorating all the time. And
what's it like for Christians living in Egypt right now?
So it's an excellent question, because it's not just how they're doing there, it's how they're doing in the whole Middle East. But in Egypt in particular, the Copts are being persecuted. They have problems every day, and there are millions of people. This is not a small community, but they're certainly under siege. There are probably 10 million Copts in Egypt, and their churches have been firebombed, and people have been attacked. In Iraq, even more of the 2 million Christians are gone. In Syria, they're fleeing. In the West Bank areas under Muslim control, they leave, and especially from Gaza, where their life is untenable. In Iran, they kill them publicly. In Turkey, they're gone. And the only place where the Christian population has increased in the last 40 years is Israel, and that's the only place people criticize.
Yeah. That's the only place where it can increase. Speaking of Israel, Netanyahu, Lapid, Bennett, all the kingmakers and major players in the most recent election, now that the government's been in formation for the last few weeks, is everybody getting along, would you say, or not?
I think that they're feeling their way, that you have people who find out that being in governance isn't so easy, that it's easy when you're on the outside, and that's true here and it's true everywhere. That once you're faced with the responsibilities, it's a lot more difficult. And I think Lapid in particular, who presented yesterday a budget to the prime minister, but everything that he said evoked some response from one party, within his party, or from outside parties of criticism. So the prime minister, people tell me, seems to be confident, and I think he has a majority. The real test will be whether they can get the budget through.
Right. And that, as you've told us, is what, the next few weeks, basically?
Yeah, the process, and they have a deadline, and that can bring a government down. But even on the peace process stuff, that Tzipi Livni and others went along, and there was more or less a unified stand about rejecting some of the steps that have been proposed during the last week. There was also pretty much unanimity on the issue of Turkey, where, again, we see Mr. Erdogan, the Secretary of State, made some comment about their complimenting them on their sensitivity when
right.
We see, in fact, that they're not moving ahead. Maybe, as one Israeli military person said, that the deterioration was halted, and made a comment that is quite mysterious about some incident, some crisis that was averted by virtue of the steps that were taken. And it was, again, as I said on the show, which a lot of people I know raised questions afterwards, that it was Israel that asked the president, and it was Israel's initiative to have the phone call made after the Prime Minister Erdogan's apology for his comments on Zionism. But you see that he's now raising the stakes again. They're not dropping the case against Israeli soldiers.
Right.
They're still demanding a lifting of the whole blockade, and he says that he will go still to Gaza, but not till after his visit to the United States on May 16th, Erdogan's visit.
And you're not willing to tell us if that was a good idea or a bad idea for Israel to make that request of the U.S. to bridge the gap with Erdogan?
I know. It is important. I think it's important.
Even in retrospect, when the stakes continue to go higher, as you just mentioned?
Anything that can reduce the deterioration, if it halted the deterioration, if it can turn things around. But at this time now, it puts the pressure on Turkey to deliver. They blocked Israel in a NATO exercise again. So now the United States at least has a stake in seeing that there's delivery on this.
Did you hear about the Second Temple era discovery this week?
About the mikvahs?
Yeah.
As I say, people are getting a message every day. God is showing us, and we just got to wake up to the reality, showing us our past.
I was proud that it seemed across the board. At least, again, the media that's focused on Israel, it seems everyone paid attention this time around and made a big deal, which it should be made, about the discovery this week. So we encourage more and more media sources to pick up these stories and to trumpet them throughout the Jewish world.
And those who say that, you know, we have invented, or you've seen this because of other debates lately about halachic issues,
right,
that this ancient mikveh is built exactly according to the halachic standards we use today. Exactly. The way that the water was collected, and the way, the size of it, and everything. So people can look at the consistency and get the real message here.
Talk about tradition, huh? And on the subject of the Jewish calendar, which is always important, but particularly this time of year as well, are you still an advocate of the March of the Living that takes place Yom HaShoah time?
I think the March of the Living is very important. For those who have gone on it, I think they've seen the impact on young people who attend, and it often depends upon who leads it, if they take full advantage to educate the young people about it. But we see increasingly, and I was involved in a discussion with a young man, and you know, they almost dismissive, not of the significance of the Holocaust, but of its relevance to people today, and especially to young people. And the March of the Living has two aspects. One is to remind us of the history, but the connection to Israel, to remind us of the future, and that to learn the lessons of that period. And it's a very dramatic. Rabbi Lau goes every year and speaks, and God willing, he should be able to do it for many more years. But I do think it's very important.
Yeah, Rabbi Lau came out with a public statement condemning those who had the nerve to make light of Yom HaShoah in general in Israel through whatever activities they were doing. And one can,
you know, I don't care whether people hold it by the government declaration, but when that moment of silence comes, anybody who violates it should be ticketed, should be punished, and every Rav and every Rosh Yeshiva has a responsibility and every Rebbe to make sure that their followers respect it, and it's such a chilul Hashem when that is violated by whatever source, left or right, or religious, non-religious, to at least have this demonstration of unity and remembrance of the Kedoshim. It's just, I've seen people violating it, and it's, I understand the reaction to it and how violent it is.
Well said. Yom HaZikaron is Monday, Israel Memorial Day. Tuesday is Yom HaAtzmaut. You've heard me say it, and I've heard you say it before, and you heard me say it earlier today, and that is that when it comes to Tuesday, take a minute and celebrate. We are amazing as a people when it comes to memorials, rightfully so. You've emphasized for us so many times how important our history is. It should always be at the forefront for both young and old, but it's sometimes time to celebrate. And guess what, Malcolm? 65 years is quite a milestone.
65 years is an important thing, and we are launching a campaign to get people to sign a birthday greeting to the people of Israel. That'll be a year long, and people can win a trip to Israel. All they have to do is go to happy65israel.com, happy65israel.com. Mm. You sign a birthday card to the people of Israel, but it's also a reminder to the world of the support, and we hope to have many millions of Jews and non-Jews around the world who will sign up. But you know, when you see the statistics that we saw this week come out of a 30% increase in anti-Semitic attacks over the past year, over the previous year, that the number of attacks and attempted attacks, that people think that these things are all behind us. When we see communities that are in need of security, they have one place to turn. So regardless of your views of the political situation or the sequence of events that should take place, anybody who doesn't step back for at least a minute and show Hakaras HaTov and to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for having the state of Israel as a refuge, as an incredible place, that all the achievements of the 65 years, that you have so many tens of, in fact, more than 100,000 people learning full-time of all the Torah that is emanating from Israel. It's really an imperative that people, you know, can degrade, and everybody, some people even think it's a sign of courage and heroism that they can demean it and dismiss it. Take a look at the world. Look at what's happening in every other country in the Middle East and see how Israel stands out, looms larger and larger for the United States, for the West, for everybody else. They can criticize it, but they all get it. And especially the Arabs get it today.
Oh, that's for sure. Well said, Mr. Honlein. Happy 65th, Israel, and we'll commemorate it properly right here. Malcolm, thank you so much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak again next week. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We get to speak to him Fridays for the weekly update. And by the way, I just signed up. happy65israel.com. I just signed the greeting. Nice logo, by the way, there, Mr. Homeline. Nice logo for Israel's 65th birthday with the flag and all that. Looks very nice.